So here with us tonight is Peter Rafferty from the UW-Madison, and he's in the Automated Vehicle Research Lab, and he's going to teach us about what's coming down the pipe. Welcome, Peter.
That's testing 1, 2, is this on? There we go. Hello, everybody. I'm an engineer too, but I'm a transportation engineer, so it's a little bit different approach. As I'm talking, I just want to, before I forget, remind you that I do have some brochures up here and another handout if you guys want to come up and grab those afterwards. So what I'd like to do is take some time and really just step through a variety of more introductory things regarding vehicle automation, what it means to have this automated vehicle proving grounds designation. But I really want to hear what questions you guys have. I was tipped off that some of you are pretty smart, so I'm hoping to hear some good challenging questions as we go through this sort of thing. Just to help me understand, has anybody been in an automated vehicle? Really of any sort? No? Has anybody been in a Tesla? Yeah? Does anybody want to be in a Tesla? Yeah, there's a few out there. So I mentioned Tesla because they're one of the automakers that has a partially automated vehicle that's available to consumers right now. It's what they call autopilot. And we'll come back to that a little bit later. So this is something that's definitely coming. There we go. Did you check to see if I didn't talk about the videos embedded in here.
I think it's in here.
Yeah. Okay, there's actually one here too, but we can skip it. So the gist of this is this is a blind man that got into one of these Google automated vehicles and is driving around town. I think it's Mountain View where Google's based there, and he's just amazed that here he is in the driver's seat of a vehicle going around town, and it works pretty smoothly. Google, they're pretty smart. They're pretty advanced in this vehicle automation area. But what was striking about this particular video is that it's already 3 or 4 years old now. And the pace of advancement is incredible. So if they're doing this 3, 4 years ago, I just want to try to paint that picture about where we are already. Some of this is background context. These slides are available on our website, or maybe you're going to make them available afterwards. So if I skip over some of these things, it's really just to try to allow more time for some Q&A and exchange as we go, so forgive me. But the Madison is situated within what we call this Great Lakes mega region, and I like to remind people of this because it's important. In the automotive world, where automakers don't really care about institutional boundaries or borders, except for the extent to which different regulations might affect their business. And so we're here in Madison, in Chicago, Detroit, Minneapolis. Somebody was here from Minneapolis, right? This is where we're really going to be seeing vehicle technology advances happen first. But that doesn't exclude some of the interstate routes, especially where it comes to commercial vehicle and freight movement. So there's a lot of different things going on here. Within Madison and in other cities, we talk about smart cities, so better data, availability, connectivity between people and vehicles and services, the shared wireless infrastructure, a whole variety of different things that enable smart city technologies. And within that are a collection of, there's a whole evolving ecosystem too of private and public sector stakeholders. So within smart cities, within the transportation part of smart cities, there are really 4 key trends going on. The first one is shared mobility, and this would include all variety of different transit and taxi, but there's also Uber and Lyft and these little shuttles like that. So anything that's getting you around that in a vehicle that you may not actually own yourself. A second one is this trend toward electrification. This is, again, something that's really going to be happening in urban areas where you have those shorter trips. You see a variety. So there's the Chevy Volt, I think, vehicle, and then the Tesla. There's a little 2-seater Innova Dash vehicle on the top. The university, UW-Madison, where I'm at, has a couple of those that we can play around with. It's basically a golf cart that looks a little slicker. The Third one is connected vehicles. So this is all the communications that are increasingly happening between vehicles and the roadside infrastructure, such as traffic signals, between vehicles and the pedestrians or wearable devices. The bicycles might have something. Motorcycles have a big role within the connected vehicle technology area. Like anyone's professional field, there's a lot of jargon and acronyms. So what these are, V2V is vehicle to vehicle, and then you have vehicle to infrastructure, vehicle to X. V2X is vehicle to everything else, so those other things that I mentioned. And of course, the Internet of Things, and then some just some drawings of what that looks like. I'm not going to talk much about connected vehicle things, though, here. I'm going to focus more on vehicle automation, which is the fourth key thing. And so we'll come back to some of these examples. Just to orient you, though, in the background, you're actually seeing what the world looks like if you're looking through it as a LiDAR sensor. So there's radio detection and ranging, that's radar. There's light detection and ranging, that's LiDAR. It's a more granular way to look at the world around you. And these vehicles, when you see these, and you will be seeing these more and more, when you see on top, they have these devices up there, and they're usually spinning pretty fast. Those are the LiDAR sensors that are looking around constantly and at a granular enough way that they can tell where the curbs are and all the different details of things that they need to do to pilot the vehicle around. So you can talk about these different things separately, connected vehicle, automated vehicles, but the magic, I always say, really happens where you have this overlap. And connected vehicle technologies have been happening, it's on a longer timeline probably than automated vehicles, but these things are increasingly converging, and they really enable each other. So you might have an automated vehicle, but I don't want people to think like, these vehicles are designed such that they're just sent off into the wilderness to find their way around. They're connected, they can be connected to the traffic signals, they can have real-time updates to the onboard base mapping through the cloud or whatnot. So there's this connectivity that enables that, and then similarly, the automation really has a lot of benefits for any type of vehicle, connected or not. You put all four of these together, and then there are all kinds of different implications, trends, and outcomes here. Safety, as a transportation engineer, a civil engineer background, that's really the key one for us. There's other implications on how much travel is going to be occurring from these vehicles, especially with shared mobility, shared vehicles like the Lyft and Uber or Zipcar, that sort of thing. On one hand, you might have more of these vehicles running around, or these vehicles operating around town more, but vehicle ownership will continue to decline at the same time. So those are counterbalancing trends in terms of how much traffic we're going to be seeing. And that's going to vary from place to place. We're really not sure. There's debate about how people think, that whole thing will play out. Sprawl, parking infrastructure, will we need all of the parking infrastructure? Those things are very expensive. Parking ramps, they're very expensive to build and maintain. There's opportunity cost and not being able to charge rents for other purposes. Energy, air, the other things that are noted on there. If anyone wants to interrupt with questions, feel free to. Regarding safety, unfortunately, each of the last 2 years have seen an increase in fatal crashes, both nationally and in Wisconsin, and this is a trend nationally that we haven't seen in 50 years. So despite all of the better road engineering, vehicle engineering, education, enforcement, lowering the blood alcohol content levels, all kinds of different policy changes that are supposed to improve the crash experience. This is going up again, and any guesses why? Yeah, text me. Pokemon Go, right? Yeah. The economy has a part of it, yep. So if you have more vehicles traveling more, your exposure to that risk is greater. But we certainly look at things in terms of crash risk on a per mile basis, and even that is still increasing. So that's definitely a good point. Yes, sir?
You have a slide showing Wisconsin.
I, what?
You have a slide showing
The bar chart on the right are the Wisconsin number of fatalities in Wisconsin. So in 2014, 500, 2016, almost 600. Yep, that's what that one is. I don't have the chart for the national figure, but that's approaching almost 40,000 deaths per year. A key thing to remember is that first bullet up there, that 90%, some you might hear 94% of all of these fatal crashes are attributable in some way to human error. So it's people driving drowsy, falling asleep, inattentive driving, distracted driving, poor reaction time to hazards, a whole variety of things. That's a big percent of those deaths. So as we work to automate more and more of the driving experience, we're really looking forward 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now to seeing that fatal crash count really, really, really come down. And that's the big bet that we're all working on. Okay. This is a graph from a report, June 2017, from a big insurance researcher, KPMG, and I put this up there because actuaries don't kid around when it comes to quantifying risk, and they're projecting a drop of about two-thirds in the total expected loss from vehicle crashes. So the personal auto liability insurance market is dropping by two-thirds between now and 2050, according to this projection. I mean, that's huge. So there's still going to be flat tires and other sort of mechanical accidents and floods, stuff like that, that vehicles will need to be insured for. So that's a big part of that remaining piece. But this trend is largely due to vehicle automation. So what is an AV? What are we talking about here, at least from my standpoint as a transportation engineer working on this? They take a lot of different forms. There are the different examples from GM, Ford, Uber, with a Ford vehicle there. There's the little Google pod car, the Tesla. In the middle is about a 10-passenger, fully automated, driverless minibus that actually exists, and it's proliferating around the world. And there are some of those operating in the U.S. already, on fixed routes on campuses generally. On the right is a case implement automated for agriculture purposes. And I'm not even including anything related to military or drones, automated drones. I'm just really talking about road vehicles primarily. Here's another one though, called a personal delivery device. This is a snapshot up at the Madison, at the Capitol Square in downtown Madison this year, where there's a manufacturer that was actually influential in getting legislation passed to allow what are called these personal delivery devices. And you can think of it as a cooler, a little six-wheeled cooler that will operate around on, that is legally able to operate around on sidewalks now. So they're working with groups like Eat Street and campus housing and food service, and they're doing this in DC and California. So that's another type of automated vehicle that you'll see coming up. I don't know if this has a lot of staying power or not, or if it's more of a novelty, but the principles of operating these are largely very similar to what it is for a full-size vehicle without nearly as much of the risk. So we're glad to have them here because that helps us learn. Very, very active industry development, and they're all, again, banking on not just millions or billions, but even trillions of dollars a shift in the market toward vehicle automation. So in addition to all the traditional automakers, there are a bunch of others that you see on there, and there are 1,000 more out there. California is a real hotbed of these tech startups that are working on all the different algorithms and the sensor technologies, sensor fusion, artificial intelligence. Those are all really big parts of this this industry. How AVs operate in the simplest way I could show a picture. It's a variety of sensors, as I've mentioned some of them. There are the cameras to gather the visual evidence to make sure they're recognizing colors of street signs or traffic signals, emergency flashing lights, those sorts of things. LiDAR, I mentioned. Radar, for radar is a longer distance. If any of you have the newer vehicles that have adaptive cruise control, where you set the cruise control and or a following distance or time, and your vehicle will adjust to the vehicle in front of it that it's following, that's using radar. So that's a very common technology. GPS, of course, for navigation and location. And the one that's not shown there but is on the top is the onboard base map. And like I said, it's not like these vehicles are just finding their way around. They work best to have a very high-definition base map already on board so they know what to expect as they're driving around. And so instead of processing everything that they're sensing and experiencing on the fly, instead what they have to look for are anything they're picking up that is different from what they expect through that base map. So if there's a traffic barrel from a work zone, or a crash, or a new pothole, or even a puddle, you can imagine if you're sensing things with LiDAR and you have, you're used to sensing a pavement with good roughness on it, and now there's a puddle, the light reflects off of that completely differently, and the vehicle may have a hard time knowing if that puddle is an inch deep or 4 feet deep. So getting into some of the more additional technologies, this proliferation of advanced driver assist systems or features is really a key step on the way to more fully automated vehicles. I mentioned the adaptive cruise control, which is listed on there, the emergency braking, the parking assist, those types of technologies are all part of the trend toward vehicle automation. What I wanted to, this is another video too, but well, I guess click on it. If it works, we'll look at it, and if not, we'll skip it. Okay, so we went on to the next slide. So that was, that's fine. Yes, we'll skip it. The video just had a real stylized animation of what a vehicle going around will notice and how it's picking up the different road signs and other vehicles and pedestrians. And then there's a picture into the back of the vehicle. It's a test vehicle from Delphi, which shows the incredible amount of hardware that's still used for these test vehicles. So this is a more complicated graph. If anyone wants it, again, it's on this handout that I have up here. But I show this just to remind people that it's not just about automating a vehicle to go out on a clear highway, that there are so many different issues that we have to figure out. And that's part of our role as university researchers and part of our role with the Automated Vehicle Proving Grounds. It's not just working on a specific sensor technology or an algorithm. There are policy implications, interactions with pedestrians and bicycles. I mentioned some of the land use implications. There are equity and healthcare. And the first, when you see that term first mile, last mile, what that refers to is enabling people to surmount that first mile, last mile barrier to mobility. So if you, for instance, don't have a car or you're blind or something, you just aren't able to drive, you really need to be located, like, for instance, close to a bus stop or a bus transfer point or some way to get around. And with vehicle automation, that starts to fall away, that sort of restriction to being within a mile of wherever you're heading to starts to fall away. If you can just hail a vehicle to come out and pick you up and then get you to your destination or to some other mode of transport. The transition, I think, is not clear, and I'm not an insurance expert either, but the trends that we're seeing is that first of all, a highly automated vehicle may operate just like a conventional vehicle with all the same controls, steering wheel and pedals, until you engage something. And so for that vehicle, if you own that, you will still have your personal liability. How that's insured once you turn control over to the vehicle system is where you'll see a shift, and the automakers and the provider of the product, so from a personal liability to a product's liability, is where that shift is going to happen. And that handoff is something that needs to be, that's just going to have to play out as these claims start showing up. Insurance companies, the big one, American Family, QBE, State Farm, you know, they're all over this in trying to figure this out. Does that sort of answer your question? Yep. If you're looking at a really highly automated vehicle that just doesn't have user controls and it's driverless, it doesn't require a human in it, that's more clearly a product's liability, or the liability would be, or the insurance would be carried by the owner or the fleet operator of that particular kind of vehicle. Yeah, it's a good question. So he mentioned the levels of automation, and this is a chart that I don't expect you to read, but guess what? It's on the back of the handout, and I have a simplified version next. The important thing is to see that you have six levels. SAE, the Society of Automotive Engineers, have these six levels of driving automation, 0 through 5, and the blue regime include where you don't have any automation, that's 0, there's the driver assist, and then partial automation. And in all of those, the expectation is that there's an operator or driver in the driver's seat actively paying attention to what's going on around them. At level 3, there, it's called conditional automation, where a driver may not need to actively monitor the driving environment, but they have to be ready to take over control if there's something goes awry. Let me preface the rest of my remarks by acknowledging that level 3 by far is the trickiest, both from a technical and a regulatory standpoint. Level 4 is high automation, where the vehicle would then be capable of going into some fail-safe mode where you need not even have a person present in the vehicle. And level 5 is a full automation. This is another view of it, so flip it on the left axis of bottom to top. We have increasing levels of automation. And then on the horizontal axis, we have anything from a very controlled test environment or test location all the way out to everywhere. And you can see in the lower right, vehicles with no automation, you can have them everywhere. Those are all the existing vehicles and older vehicles. Newer vehicles just about always have some sort of driver assist feature, and you can operate those everywhere. The Tesla Autopilot I mentioned is then what we call a partial automation, where it's still in this shaded area where a driver is expected to be actively paying attention. And I tell you what, if you think distracted driving is a problem now, as these vehicles take over more of the driving task at levels 2 and 3 especially, it really is inviting increasing distraction if you don't even have to have your hands on the wheel and the vehicle's keeping it in its lane. I mean, how easy is it to turn your attention to your newspaper or fall asleep or what? So navigating this era of, I call that the messy middle. And navigating that era is a real challenge. Not all automakers are bothering with this level 2 and 3 stuff. Tesla is an example that I keep bringing up because they're very open about doing that. Google, which is now the Google self-driving part of their business. So Google is now part of Alphabet, and also a part of Alphabet is something called Waymo. And Waymo, so if you hear me say Google, now we are actually talking about Waymo. That's the self-driving vehicle.
Hi.
Yeah.
I love the story from a couple of years ago about a self-driving vehicle, and there was a guy behind the wheel.
Yeah.
And he saw a situation coming up, so he took control. And that's when the accident happened.
Oh, yeah.
I thought it was great.
Yeah, so the driver error, and the system may have been doing the right thing and the driver took over. That's very common in the airline industry. There's a great deal of automation for pilots, and they're actually actively piloting the airplane a relatively low percent of the time. And some of the problems happen when the autopilot is responding very aggressively and vigorously to something, but the pilot takes over and screws it up. So that's related to that. So now with this messy middle, what happens is, there we go. Year and a half ago, this is a Tesla crash. I'm sorry, Tesla, but you're the one out there doing this. The driver was operating at level 2 partial automation. The vehicle was going down the highway, and a semi-truck coming toward it was turning left in front of it, and the vehicle sensors just failed to pick up, and the vehicle just failed to react to the truck. Without even stopping, it drove right underneath the trailer and sheared off the top of the vehicle and the driver. Terrible fatality. You remember this one? In principle, very much the same thing. Working in automated mode, and people weren't paying attention like they should have been, and people died because of it. And then there was another one after that, too. This is March of this year. This is a dash cam of a snapshot of a dash cam video. The vehicle in front is a Tesla that was coming up into this work zone, and you can kind of see the dotted pavement marking there. That's the new temporary work zone pavement marking, and then the yellow barrier is coming in from the left. The vehicle just kept going down the existing lane and drove right into the barrier. Now, in these cases with Tesla, they're finding that Tesla is actually not at fault with this because it is still level 2 and the driver is supposed to be actively monitoring the driving environment. But they're not, and then they get into these crashes. Another driver error with Uber in a Volvo vehicle down in one of the Southwest states, where the again with an oncoming left turn vehicle and the Uber vehicle was coming down. It had one of these trained operator engineers, you know, in the driver's seat. It might have been operating at maybe a level 3 or something, but. The vehicle turned in front of it and then it just failed to respond accurately. Now, in those situations, if you deconstruct this, a human driver may have just approached the situation differently from how the software was doing it, and it ended up in that crash. And then here, this is a picture from Europe where some prankster actually built a trap for an automated vehicle. I got sick of it. So I call this an AV timeline, not the timeline, because any estimate's debatable and things are always changing. But what I try to reassure people that you'll hear that maybe automated vehicles in some sense are here already, and that's true. But I don't want anyone to think like it's going to be flipping a switch in 3 years and you'll have these fully automated vehicles available to consumers from Toyota. And I forgot, somebody here asked a question about the cost of these vehicles, and I forgot to come back and answer that, actually, because I got distracted by the levels of driving automation. So these things are coming, and they'll be at levels 3 and 4, you know, in a few years, and available to consumers. And the incremental cost is large. I mean, there's a lot of development that's going into this, but the incremental cost isn't nearly what you might think it is. If you're taking a conventional vehicle, adding some sensors, and the cost of those sensors they drop tenfold, you know, year after year. So these LiDAR sensors used to be six figures, and now they're, you know, like $1,000 right now. So it's really not adding that much, and that cost will continue to come down. So I wouldn't expect these things to be terribly expensive, but in the take the case of Tesla, of course, those are pretty expensive vehicles, and that's where we're seeing it first. So as the years go on, it'll just be increasingly common. So I don't know if you've been looking at that while I was chatting, but by 2020, I said these limited and conditional, level 3 automated vehicles are really going to be widely available to consumers. And then within another 5 years, we're going to see the proliferation of these shared autonomous fleets operated by Uber and Lyft and others maybe operating things. There are all kinds of new partnerships forming between GM, Ford, Volvo, Toyota, and those other mobility providers, so that's definitely coming. The advantage they have for really pushing the proliferation of these automated vehicles is that they, as they operate as a fleet, they'll have a 24/7 operations center where people will be able to tap into the vehicles and either take over or communicate with the passenger. You take over remote driving if there's a need or something goes wrong, or the driver needs help. You know, they're not just abandoned in a vehicle by themselves. So that's an advantage of having AVs as part of a fleet versus a personally owned vehicle. And then it goes on from there. And then by 2040, that's when we're going to see the increasing turnover of the fleet starting to show. So I was presenting to a group of insurance people a while back, and I showed this timeline, and basically the discussion came around to, well, let's look at where their retirement year was on this timeline to see how much of this they're actually going to have to deal with. It was pretty funny. And then that very last one, 2100, looking out, a couple of more generations from now, think back 100 years about the transition from the horse-based transportation and pedestrian-based to the vehicle. That's a big transformation. I don't know if this will be as big as that will, but it's certainly the biggest thing that we've seen in transportation since that. So looking forward to 2100, it may mean that you can still operate your own vehicle, just like you can still ride a horse. You can't do it in a lot of places. And there may be special places and times where you'll be able to drive yourself.
Teleportation will replace all of it.
Yeah, then there's that, yep, the wormholes and things. The Jetsons comes up a lot, I'm talking about surface automation, but there are passenger drones, and those will be automated, and that's something that Dubai is working on this summer. So that's going to be something for personal mobility that we'll see before that timeline is over. And if anyone's curious, the Jetsons is 2062, year 2062, because it came out in 1962, and it was thinking ahead 100 years. It's not that far off, except George wouldn't be driving that vehicle. He would just be riding in it. I don't know how much you want to get into policy, or if you've got other questions. Yeah, back in the back.
I understand that the radar is operating at 90 gigahertz, and IBM is a big developer of the chipsets for that. Have you heard that?
IBM? Yes.
It's 90 gigahertz radar.
Okay.
And IBM is developing the chipsets for it, is what I had heard.
Yeah, I believe it. It's a big area. NVIDIA and Intel are other two really big players in this area for processing all of that sensor data. And in addition to the stuff coming from the radar, you have all the LiDAR, there's ultrasonic sometimes, and then the camera, the video processing as well. So the hardware demands are really, really quite remarkable. I will say that I did say I am a civil engineer and transportation engineer, not a computer science or computer engineer, so I can't speak too much about the details of that technology.
Oh, I look forward to the day when I don't own a vehicle. I just call one up, it comes to the door, and I jump in, and then I can text and drive at the same time because I'm not driving, the vehicle is. So that, to me, that makes a lot of sense.
Without showing my own cards, there's quite a bit of debate about, or not debate, but sentiment about that. Some people are more than willing to just give up their vehicle. Others are like, no way, I don't want to ever give up driving myself around.
Does your department at the university plan on studying the airborne vehicles?
No, not at this point. Much of the technology and principles are very transferable to those types of vehicles. One of the barriers to airborne personal mobility is the cost. It's very energy intensive to lift a lot of weight through the air. So we'll have to. We're still working on coming up better ways to address the energy issue back here first.
You
mentioned the communication to infrastructure, and I wonder about those, like that car crash where the Tesla drove into the barrier. Mm-hmm. Is there any discussion to that cars and talking to like construction crews and how that interface happens? Is that something that's being looked at?
Yes, there's a couple of things there. DOT, state DOTs and other transportation agencies have the best information about where and when work zones are active. That's one of the things that they're very good at in terms of accuracy of information. And they're increasingly good at getting that out to the public through some automated data feeds. And that's what you'll see when you bring up your Google Maps or if you go to a state's 511 traveler information system. There are a lot of different flavors of it, and you see the work zone icons there. That's what that is. An automated vehicle should have that same information as part of their base map that's updated all the time, so that if they're going down a highway and they're approaching one of these work zones, they can, if it's a level 3, they would certainly alert the driver to say, I'm coming up on something, I don't know what to expect, you need to be ready to take over control. And then on the base mapping thing too, is if one vehicle picks up an anomaly like a work zone or some lane change, or maybe there's a flooding or something, what we'd like to see is for that information to be transmitted up to the cloud and made available, so that information sharing. But there's a lot of concerns about like competitive advantage among these fleets. But if we can get past that and the privacy and security and cybersecurity and anonymity things, you know, all those, you know, right, no big deal, then, you know, there's a lot of promise there.
So I guess this is a bit of a philosophical question. Driving in a vehicle, whether you're driving or it's driving yourself, is an inherently risky activity. And I've read studies have shown human beings are more likely to engage in a risky activity if they have some level of control over the outcome, right. I.e. driving the vehicle would be the level of control that you have. And you've shown at least statistical projection that it's much safer to be in an automated vehicle. Do you think that there are going to be a certain portion of people who are very resistant to adopting this or accepting it?
Yes. Yeah, you put it very well. It's a curious thing when it comes to the impact of automation and robotics on human safety, and the amount of harm that humans accept from each other is so much greater than from an automated machine. So even if, like, so, and that's part of the policy hurdle, is the vehicle automation, there's a lot more available that could be out there right now if we were willing to accept some of the problems and some of the crashes caused by these automated systems. But we're very risk averse that way when it comes to harm that comes from a vehicle. So that's probably the best I can do right now on that. Here.
Are they, you think it's being thought about that once a vehicle is totally autonomous, mm-hmm. I've got one of those cars at home, I want to send it to go pick up my kid from school.
Right.
So I hop on my laptop, feed in the address, the car takes off and goes.
Well, voice command, right.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, without being in the car, I'm just sitting in my chair at home watching the game while it goes to get my kid.
Right.
Is that...
That's where we're heading.
Is that where they're...
Yeah, I think that sort of thing will happen if, you know, the wealthier people will have access to their own personal vehicle that could do something like that, but eventually there may be nothing preventing you from dispatching a taxi or Uber or something.
Well, I could see a news department having a couple of autonomous cars. They get a call that says, well, there's a fire somewhere, so they plug it in. They send the car. It's got an in-car camera, so they're looking. Right. Is it important, a big enough fire? Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, now they launch the drone that's on the roof of the car to fly up 40 feet, get 20 minutes of footage, and then send the footage back to the station without sending anybody. But there is an operator. They're at the station in a edit booth that controls the car and the drone.
Right. Yeah. You mentioned that, and the some transportation agencies use those drones for incident response. I mean, not necessarily automated, but just getting something up in the air to look around is. Yeah, it's, you know, the opportunity is incredible to really assess a situation quickly or to get it on your TV.
First, I note that the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration rejects apparently the need for ethical considerations or privacy, which is kind of interesting,
right,
as an aside. But what about artificial intelligence in the sense that a hypothetical, your autonomous vehicle is driving down the road. It's a bridge. Two children come out in front of it. What does the car do? Does the car go off the bridge to kill you but save the two children? Does it kill the two children?
Mm-hmm.
And who's liable for it when it happens?
Right, right.
Because it will happen.
It will happen. Yes, it will, indeed. And if a human has to make that decision right now, it's chalked up to making the best choice, best call you can in the moment. But if a machine does it, that's a different thing from a liability standpoint. And I put this up here to... thank you for noticing that, because the initial policy came out last September under the previous administration, and the update this September, there were some points on the last slide about it being optional and, you know, voluntary, so it's a very light touch, but they also did scratch those things that I noted on there. So data recording, sure, but sharing, no. Ethical considerations. That's a very tricky one, and there's a whole other discussion that we could have on that. If you're curious about this issue, check out moralmachine.mit, Massachusetts Institute of Technology.edu, and what they've done is they put together initially they were doing some research where they presented visitors with two different scenarios, ethical considerations, and you there's little information about each one, and you have to select one. You just have to. And the situation in the top left there is the automated vehicle is coming down. There's a barrier, a couple of barriers. There's some pedestrians that came out on a don't walk signal in an unexpected way. So you're traveling down the road, these two people just come out right in front of you, and your choice is fundamentally, do you evade it somehow and put your own passengers at risk, or do you continue down and harm the people that are in the crosswalk? And it's a tricky situation. That's, you know, there aren't any good answers. Fortunately, the instances of this will be very rare. And I say that because a machine, or these sensors are, constantly monitoring the environment around them. So an automated vehicle will see those people before a human will. It will react to that a lot faster than a human will. And it will know, may very well just be able to stop. And guaranteed it will be able to stop a lot faster than a human would be able to. And then the one on the lower right, if you saw that, makes you choose between killing the dogs or the cats.
Ouch.
So there's...
I don't think my wife would like that one.
It got very popular, so they let people submit their own situations.
Okay. Yeah. My question is, maybe I missed it, but do you have any actual statistics today on automated car crashes versus human car crashes? Not yet.
No, just too rare, and... we are there. There is a growing amount, a wealth of data on the advanced driver assist features reducing crashes. So those rear end fender benders, for instance, in the vehicles that are equipped with that emergency brake assist, those are declining. The lane departure warnings, those probably annoying to a lot of people that have them, but in some cases they are showing that they help. In particular for commercial vehicles truck drivers, where they're doing these long routes, and if there's some sort of virtual rumble strip, if they are veering off onto the lane line, that sort of thing. So there's some increasing data about the benefits of those, and that's why largely those are proliferating. So we expect that trend to continue, but as far as these level 3-4 vehicles, there just isn't enough data.
So two questions. One's fun and one's serious. One of my wife's favorite memories from the mid-1980s of driving is being in her Monte Carlo her dad had bought her. She pulls up to a stoplight on a somewhat rural road around Cleveland, Tennessee. Next to her pulls up a state trooper. She rolls down her window. She's in her tube top looking pretty hot. Yeah. She says, "Wanna race?" My granddaughter will never get to experience that, will she? Not that I'd want her to, but...
right. Yeah, tube tops will still be available.
So, you drive around a lot of rural areas, and you see what we might used to have called a jalopy, a poorly maintained car. What will an AV jalopy look like? What will bad maintenance imply for these kind of cars? Maybe we come along to 2050 or 2060, mm-hmm. and we have some 15, 20-year-old cars that haven't been maintained.
Yeah, great question. Yeah, and that brings up all kinds of issues with liability. If you have a very nice new automated vehicle, but it gets bumped by a non-automated shopping cart in a parking lot, it bumps into a sensor and knocks it over, then your car may not be... and your car would know this. You may not be able to drive it in an automated way, but what if you are, but the sensor is off? And then how do you fix that? You have to get that to a certain certified mechanic who has this extra training to fix that thing and get it recertified. So it's a tricky, very tricky thing. And how that plays out is a very, very murky future in terms of the maintenance of these things. But the market and the liability, who's accepting the liability, I think is really going to drive those decisions.
I'm thinking that an automated Jeep Wrangler or other off-road mudding vehicle is just not going to make much sense.
In rural areas for farming or recreational things, those are all the last places where you'll see any sort of requirement for automation. Yeah, these are definitely urban. They'll start in urban areas.
What kind of progress is being made on the security end of things in terms of basically, you have these AI systems, and if you can't decode what the AI system is deciding in some kind of human understandable language, how can you really assign blame? And then, the security end of it really also could be, if somebody manipulates small parts of the AI system, then you can have crashes that occur just because of tiny decisions that are forks to the way the AI is deciding.
That's right, yeah. This is all part of the research and development work, especially in the computer science department that's working on those sorts of things. So you mentioned a couple of different things, tweaks to the AI or just simple design decisions in developing these algorithms, which may have consequences that nobody ever foresaw. And then you also mentioned the cybersecurity. What if there's some malicious intent or hacking that would affect that? And how do you assign the liability for that? It's a great question, but it's a very active area of development. And you saw on that last policy slide, number 7, vehicle cybersecurity. And the data recording is in part to get back at that, but it's still in there, but it's from a federal policy so far, it's just voluntary for the automakers to come up with the best they can at this point.
So I'm trying to understand the level of automation that these cars can achieve. What about, can they park themselves anywhere?
Yeah, they certainly can. Those level 3 and 4, but even the level 1 driver assist, that's the one where you see in the commercials, you pull up to a parallel parking spot and hit the button and the wheel spins and it'll parallel park for you. So yeah, they're getting pretty good at that sort of thing. Even operating inside of parking structures or underground structures where the environment is really different and you don't have a GPS signal, if they have some sort of mapping of that or even able to just sense their way through, they tend to do a really good job at parking better than humans in a lot of cases. Yeah.
Obviously, we're glad you're doing this here in Wisconsin and in Madison. Yeah. Is there anything unique about the climate that you can speak to? If you're driving along and your sensors are finally covered with road salt,
or you're
going over craters of ice, are there any special considerations that you wouldn't get in the Southwest?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is one of the advantages of being a northern climate for the automated vehicle things. Like I said, you don't send these vehicles out into the wilderness because the first thing that'll happen up here is that it'll snow and the vehicle can no longer see where the pavement markings are. They may not even be able to tell where the curbs are once the snow is piled up. So they have to have that accurate base mapping for that, and that's a big reason for that. Something you might hear from, especially like 3M, the pavement marking and signing and Post-its company, and others like them, you'll hear them really push the idea or the notion that agencies have to upgrade and improve all of their pavement marking and road signing to really good standards so that these vehicles have a clear way to navigate around. But I don't think that really is going to have much traction for the reason I just mentioned, because things change, work zones happen. You'll never get all the agencies to get state-of-the-art traffic control markings and devices out there with all the budget issues in transportation agencies. So it's something that is part of the work we're doing up here. I did show this map before I come back to you of these. There were these 10 designated AV proving grounds, and that's primarily what brought me here today, is that this just got designated in January. We did as one of these 10. There is activity elsewhere, and the type and the scale of activity really ranges quite a lot. There's even a Department of Defense, U.S. Army's Aberdeen Test Center in Maryland that's on there. And talk about good funding. We don't actually have funding right now. If you're all mostly Wisconsin, right? Just about everybody. And so we have budget problems, right? And the Department of Transportation is part of that. So they're working on reprioritizing things. And so we're definitely working with the private sector. Yeah, there's one back here.
Okay, what was brought up was environment, and you mentioned that if there's snow, there's going to be issues. Now, when you take a look at some of the road maintenance issues that have been done in the past, in wintertime up here, you can have a four-lane, like two parking lanes and travel lanes in the middle, mm-hmm. like lane two and three, but one and four are supposed to be for parking. Well, when it comes to snow plowing, one and four are used for where the snow ends up, and they only keep the two in the middle open. How's the car supposed to sense that if it's supposed to ignore rain normally? And if it's mapped into it that it is a four lane with parking and that type of thing, is it going to recognize a snowbank as being an object to avoid?
It'll avoid it for sure. And that's one of those edge cases, on that spiderly diagram I showed up there. The automakers may paint a very rosy picture of these things and say, hey, in 3 years, you're going to have your highly automated vehicle and you're good to go. But it doesn't take long to think about all the different edge cases like that, that these vehicles will have to be able to figure out. Similarly, especially on East Washington over here in Madison, where you have three fairly narrow travel lanes and then it snows, if it's really actively snowing, you don't get three vehicles driving down that abreast anymore. You got two vehicles just trying to share whatever space they can. You can't see any pavement markings. And you gotta throw the base map out the window at that point and let the vehicle do its best. Yeah.
Once these become more ubiquitous, do you think that
states would get to the point where, okay, if you have we're gonna designate Interstate 35 as automated cars only? So you don't have manual operators, it's only automated cars.
Yeah, I think that will be the case, but not. That's more decades away, a big policy shift like that, because it will take a long time for conventional vehicles to be phased out. What we might see sooner than that are certain areas within urban centers that will be limited to automated vehicles or shared mobility vehicles, and then maybe on these highways, maybe certain lanes will be restricted to the highly automated and or connected vehicles. I'll just keep clicking through here some of this stuff so you can see it as we go. That's on the handout too. There's that LiDAR image. Make sure. Yeah, go ahead. I'll come back to that.
I have in the television business now, we're running into a situation, if not already very soon, where we have automated news productions, and stations more and more are running out of people in the building who know how to run a video switcher in case the automation switches crashes. So at some point, you keep alluding that the car will go back to manual control and then back to automation, depending on what it's sensing. What happens when we get to the point where people don't know how to drive anymore?
Right. I don't know. I hope that's after I'm retired. Yeah.
We won't have to worry about that.
Right. I mean, a serious point on that is that fallback control is where you're going to see that work better in those shared mobility fleets like Lyft or Uber, where you have an operations center where your passengers may be using these shared vehicles, and if something goes awry, you will have a trained operator to even figure out what needs to happen remotely.
Or I'm guessing the vehicle will err on the safe side and just stop.
Yeah, but yeah, get out of traffic and stop, right?
Yeah, yes. So it's not that serious a thing. Maybe an inconvenience for the passenger.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So here's a fun one. It's kind of a corollary to his. We're in Wisconsin here. We get really good snowfalls. What happens before the plows come through, or for like the 2 or 3 days after when the plows still haven't come?
Right. It's a good thought experiment. Something that's come up when you have heavy snowfall and the plows haven't come through and some vehicles are driving is you get the big ruts in there, and the surface from a sensor point of view, it's hard to tell just how rigid certain edges are that it's picking up, and it may very well hesitate to drive on something that looks like somebody just dropped down a bunch of railroad ties or something when it's actually snow. A lightweight Mylar balloon's another example. You throw one of those in front of a LiDAR and it looks more serious than it actually is.
People will decide you shouldn't be driving if the road's that bad.
Right. Yeah. Right. So I just want to make sure you guys were aware of some of the facilities we have here in Wisconsin. So in addition to the lab-based and simulation stuff, which I wasn't going to get into too much, we do have this MGA research facility down by Burlington, southeast of here. And it's a 400-acre test track that was a former American Motor Corp facility. And the Jeeps were kind of born in this area. I see somebody nodding. Remember the Gremlin? Automate one of those. And the Pacer, yeah. So they've been operating it for 30 years now, this company, and they've got a dozen or so locations around, mostly in the U.S. And they have that area in the lower left where you see the curves through the woods. It's very hilly, and it's an underutilized section of their track. And they said, hey, if you've got something you want to come and test here, we're glad to just make that available for some innovative automotive testing. So they have existing clients like Toyota, Nissan, Waymo has been there, Tesla has been there, largely for crash testing and certain component testing, environmental conditions. They've done some work with the military even. So it's a really good partner to have on board if there's a need or an interest from somebody else to get out there in a closed, safe, secure, private environment to do testing like that. Not that we're going to race automated vehicles, but the Road America facility up by Elkhart Lake is a nice place to showcase and demonstrate certain things. They get good media attention. They have very big events where we might be able to get an automated shuttle up there. They have great connections to automotive enthusiasts and the car industry, so they're a partner. Not too active right now, but they've been a good partner and very willing to work with us. Our own university campus, we also have private corporate campuses like Epic Healthcare, American Family Insurance are examples. We're not doing any testing out there right now, but the advantage of having those private corporate campuses is that there are certain rules, regulations, policies that would restrict the use of certain types of automated vehicles on public roads that you can operate on private campuses like that, like Epic or AmFam, not the UW campus. Oh, the picture in the upper right is worth checking out because you get these situations like that where if you're an automated vehicle, on game day, it just gets so tricky to navigate that. And then, take this into the winter when it's snowing at night at bar time, around State Street. I mean, if you can solve that, you win, basically the automated vehicle race. And then, just a whole variety of different things here. I did want to mention that our Governor Walker last May issued an executive order to create the steering committee, no kidding, on connected and automated vehicles. The tone of it is very good, in my opinion, in terms of removal of barriers to testing and deployment. So it was a very, hey, we got to regulate this and, ensure all these things. It's more about removing the barriers, making sure that we're set up from a policy and regulatory standpoint to accommodate everything that's happening right now and in the years to come. So we did, I'm on that committee. The others, there's a whole bunch of others listed there as well. 20-some people. You see some big players like... From industry like Waymo, Uber. So remember, Waymo is what Google is now for automated vehicles. Uber, Tesla, Alliance of Automotive or Auto Manufacturers, global automakers. These are the big DC lobbyists for Volvo and Volkswagen, and they're part of these different groups. And then local companies like Harley Davidson, Schneider Trucking. So it's a good group. We just had one meeting. We have the next one next Wednesday, actually. But it's really to tackle the questions that exist on the statutory and regulatory and rules and all those sorts of things. Figure out what agencies need to be involved and make sure that we're engaging all of those. Maybe identify certain facilities for testing and deployment. I guess that's kind of the crux of it so far. So far, Wisconsin's really been in a legal gray area when it comes to automated vehicles, which is good and bad. What else do we have here? Oh, some more things that you can look at on our website. Yeah. So I've got some cards. Like I said, I got the handouts here. If you want to grab that, wiskav.org, you send an email to that, and it usually just ends up in my inbox. So be glad to connect with any of you if anything else comes up. I'm not seeing other questions, so maybe we just wrap up here. I'm glad to stick around for a little bit. If you want to come up or ask something more specific, I'll stick around. Maybe I'll have one of your beers even. Yeah. 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 Yes, sir.
I'm curious, what happened with the Tesla, the one with the top taken off? I understand that was a vehicle driving into the sun and with a white truck in front of it.
Right.
Have they corrected that error in the programming?
Yeah, they have. They were able to do it right away. One curious thing, in my opinion, that Tesla eschews is the use of LiDAR detectors. They're relying primarily on camera and radar. And in that case, if the camera failed to pick up a white truck on a white background, a radar should have done it. And that's where part of the problem happened, is that there was the sensor fusion between the different messages that where it was receiving wasn't quite right. And then, that's my understanding of it anyway. I don't know all the details, other than the NHTSA and the National Transportation Safety Board that investigates these things absolved Tesla of any culpability because the driver was supposed to be paying attention.
Okay, any more? All right, Peter, thank you very much.
All right.
Excellent program.
Okay, good. Thank you. Thanks for having me.